Okay, so it's the November edition of Horizon Unpacked, and we're sat in the Scardy offices by the window, and it's that time of day where really the nighttime is drawing in, and it's got that real kind of year-end feel about it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you may hear a bit of joviality from some of the other offices, because it's that time of year too. In fact, after this, I'm heading out for my first Christmas drinks of the season. Have you got any?
Very nice. I'm just out locally this evening, just down a pub on the road. Nothing too exciting. But anyway, yes, it kind of definitely feels like we're moving to that time of year. And yeah, Alex could have some interesting editing to do. We get a lot of noise in the store office. All various trucks and lorries driving past. Anyway, we'll see how it pans out.
But that's really, you know, also a bit of the flavour of this Horizon, because we've gone again for issuance. We've talked about issuance. We've gone for convertible bonds. And the reason is that it's around this time of year that you get the real pressure to bring deals.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and I really felt that, you know, when I've been a lead manager and, you know, personally, you know, the team I ran topped the ranks in Asia in 2006, and it was a very typical year for issuance. And you know, that was characterized by me heading back for a kind of Christmas trip back to the UK. And I remember being in friends' kitchens and being on calls talking about new deals that we were going to have to bring before the year end.
And it's just a year end driven thing. So as in everyone's desperate to get as many over the line they can in December. But obviously the last week or so of December, I mean, is dead, I assume, or we can be busy even then.
Yeah, so it's this time of year, you're kind of planning the issues. The pushes are, there's definitely sort of an internal push from the sell side firms who are trying to get calendar, trying to get league table. Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, aggressive around stuff, or they can be aggressive around deals, particularly if they're trying to set out their stall and achieve some kind of recognition into the year end. But of course, for companies, it's that pivotal time where they're trying to get the books closed, they're trying to show that their financing is good. You know, many companies have their year end at year end, others don't. You know, we don't, of course, we're in July, August, but a lot of companies do.
And would a company, sorry for my naivety, not really coming from the debt side, would a company possibly have debt that would finish at the calendar year end? So you're looking to roll, or is it?
Absolutely. Can it be a random? So you do have refinancing to do, and you know the kind of paper that you're issuing is typically, you know, 5-year paper or maybe 3-year paper. It may also be the case that you've offered some kind of put to bondholders as well, and so you do have refinancing pressure. And in fact, you know what. When we're looking at what's happening in the next year, S&P is saying in the high yield market, there's $247.7 billion of paper that needs to be refinanced next year. And then that rises to $389.3 billion. You know, in the UK, in the mortgage market, there's a big step up in the amount of mortgages that have got to be refinanced in the next 12 months.
2-year, 3-year things, whatever that comes out.
And then you've got the pressure from US government debt. A third of the outstanding US government debt is going to mature in the next 12 months. That's $7.6 trillion worth. So no doubt about it, there's a lot of refinancing pressure around. And I guess that what we're trying to highlight this time, and again, it's because people don't necessarily have long memories in finance, or you know, maybe some people do, and they you know, conjure up some great product from the mists of time. And everyone kind of forgets the dangers of that product. So we've highlighted two. So the first one is, it's actually not that controversial product. Premium redemption convertible bond. It's just, you know, you issue it at 100.
Right.
And then the maturity level is where it would be to pay the interest due on the debt. So it could be issued at 100, matures at 135. Over 5 years, that would be like around about 5% a year for, 7% a year for 5 years, for example. But the danger with that, and this is why it's a kind of an interesting feature of the convertible bond market, because of course issuers have this out. If their share prices perform and the stock goes up, everyone converts out of the bond into the shares.
Right, and then you don't have any interest
Well, not any interest. You don't even have the principal due. The whole thing evaporates. It's magic. It's magic, and you've achieved a share sale at a premium to the prevailing price because you know, if you issue these at whatever, a 30% premium or something like that, then issuers are happy because they've got a, you know, share price, a share sale higher than where the stock is now. And it kind of happens over time, you would hope, as people convert gradually. But of course, the danger can be if you get a very steep decline in the share price during the life of that convertible bond,
right,
where it isn't going to get converted. And of course, you know, steep falls happen. They can happen for macro reasons, but if they happen to the share price for micro reasons, because the company is in difficulty, in trouble, then there's no way, or it becomes very, very hard for them to find that extra bit of money because they haven't been paying coupon all along the life of that bond. So this is something that really kind of came out in the Indian market, and it's, you know, it's 20 years ago. I remember going to Citigroup, actually, in Asia, who are the big issuer, big lead manager of convertible bonds, and the guy that ran equities asking me, saying, why is it people will pay such exorbitant levels for convertible bonds in this market? I can't understand it. You know, he was issuing into it and very happy with the fees they were earning, but he was nervous. And it's true that these Indian stocks had huge growth rates and people were prepared to lend money for that growth.
Right.
And the other feature about India at that time was it was hyper rare to get a coupon. Bonds weren't issued with coupons because Indian companies were, you know, would moan about the tax implications for them. So everyone got used to this 0% premium redemption structure. You know, things issued on big premiums, you know, 50% premiums. The stock's got to do a lot of work, you know, 10% a year for 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, obviously these are rough and ready numbers, but, you know, you can see the numbers. And in 2006, there was a mini sort of domestic credit crisis where one of the local banks, ICICI, stopped providing credit hedges. And that really kind of locked up the market. And there was a kind of a mini fall. And then that was followed 2 years later by the 2008 global financial crisis, and India was impacted just like everywhere else. And you had a lot of bonds that had been issued in that previous sort of five-year window that now couldn't be refinanced. And in fact, the market caps of the companies were smaller than the outstanding debts on the CBs.
Wow.
You know, it was really, you know, and that wasn't the case when they'd been issued. You know, you might have a $500 million company market cap issuing $100 million worth of bonds.
Yeah.
And then, you know, by the time of the financial crisis, the market cap is sort of 60 million. You know, it's fallen heavily.
And it's got a lot outstanding.
And now the outstanding's gone up to 130 million.
Yeah.
You know, pretty frightening stuff. So that's the premium redemption CB kind of warning, if you like. And the reason why we're warning about it is because if you have companies that are struggling and are trying to preserve cash, then they are going to be attracted by these kind of, you know, pay it all at the end kind of structures, especially if, you know, they're very bullish on the share price and they just think, well, it's okay, the whole thing's going to get converted out.
Yeah.
So something for issuance committees to be, you know, alive to and alert to, really think about the consequences of issuing this kind of paper. You know, what could the impact be? And, you know, there's obviously a duty of care to the issuers, but also to the bondholders as well. Obviously, you'd expect bondholders to get better terms than they would on a normal CB because they're not getting the interest till right at the end and they're going to have to finance that paper.
Yeah.
And rates are quite high. So you'd also think that people wouldn't necessarily be that ready to receive that kind of paper. But if the terms are right, people will. So that's the kind of warning there. And then the other one, which is really is a toxic product, which is a kind of warning out of the mists of time, which is the MSCB. And, I like resonance. So, you know, premium redemption, we talk about from 20 years ago. Well, we can talk about moving strike convertible bonds. And the kind of the last instance that I'm kind of aware of was a fraud conducted by Magna Group, which was around about 10 years ago. It was actually year end 2012. Into 2013. Again, it's year ends. But I really got to know about moving strike convertible bonds when I was at Lehman Brothers, because in 2005, Lehman Brothers did an 80 billion yen financing for Livedoor Inc., who was attempting to acquire Fuji TV. And this was a very controversial transaction for a number of reasons. One, the acquisition of Fuji TV was hostile, and that That's kind of very rare. Very rare in Japan. Very kind of, you know, not the done thing. And then, of course, you had this US bank financing, bringing, you know, Western attitudes over into Japan. So that kind of, you know, upset, you know, I think things domestically. But, you know, with a moving strike convertible bond, what happens is you have a bond that is issued that is already deep in the money. Mm-hmm. But then to ensure that it, you know, it stays deep in the money, you move the strike every day so that it remains in the money. And when bondholders convert, they receive their shares, they sell, the share price falls. It doesn't matter because everything resets. So they convert, they get more shares and they sell. And there's that persistent selling pressure on the share price. And what happens is that you have, they're called death spiral CVs or toxic convertible bonds.
And this is in the original terms that this paper being issued a few years ago, or is this paper issued now?
It was absolutely issued. It was issued 2005, right. And it was it's such a kind of, you know, the whole market is aware of it because it's so noisy, because right. The stock goes limit down day after day after day. You know, the company doesn't even have to report that it's kind of done this, especially if they've done the issue privately. But everyone is aware of it. And, you know, there will have been rumblings in the market and people will, you know, become aware of it. And, you know, purportedly, you know, Lehman Brothers made 15 billion yen off an 80 billion yen issue, right. Which, again, people smart against, you know, the company got its money, but at what cost to smaller shareholders? And then you have the wider, you know, customer-facing convertible bond franchise. And this is why I knew about it, because I didn't have a piece of that private. It was done by a prop desk. But being the person that was facing off against all of the customers, you know, the amount of pressure we got, you know, why weren't we showed that deal? It's ludicrous. Right. We're supporting your franchise. You know, why are you, you know, and then you don't show us these kind of piece of paper. We support you through the bad deals and all this kind of pressure. That happens, but reputationally, it is damaging for your, you know, or can be damaging for your business. So they are definitely, you know, a toxic product. They're something that you need enhanced due diligence around, and that's you know where the case of the Magna Group one is such a fascinating case, because that was actually a fraud. There were fake promissory notes issued, which converted into shares of a company, Lustros Inc. And then they took those shares after converting them and sold them to unsuspecting retail investors. And that's, you know, the SEC.
Right. So the shares that you could convert into didn't even, well, they existed, but they were account.
They were unregistered.
Right.
Okay. So these weren't even tradable. And you got these unsuspecting people, you know, dump the shares. That was a case where I think they made about 25. The four individuals involved in the scheme made about $25 million. Wow. And again, it's generally down, you know, the sharper end of the market. So it's something that will occur where there's not a lot of transparency. It could be kind of penny stocks. It's also where you have a company where, you know, they're absolutely desperate for cash. And this is a way of, you know, guaranteeing the cash because the structure is so cheap to the bondholder. You know, they are sure to make a killing on this. And the people that are really impacted are the small investor, the retail investor. So those are the kind of the two warnings out of the mists of time. And it's at year end where, you know, pressure for calendar is high. People will start to, you know, take their eye off the ball, maybe take a few chances on things to get things over the line, maybe a bit more aggressive. Be more aggressive on the corporate side as well if they're desperate to refinance and get their cash. So that's the warning.
Right. Okay. But, I mean, you'd still think that, you know, you'd need new product approval for these type of things. I mean, do you think we're just sort of saying, you know, these committees still need to be aware if something's trying to be shoved through. You need to please have a close look at the terms.
Yeah, so I think whenever you have issuance, you should have some kind of issuance committee where you're laying out the terms of the transaction, laying out the risk. You hope that committee is well represented, because you've got to have all the stakeholders there. You know, has the due diligence been done? Has the client been adopted? Has the client been onboarded? What are the proceeds of fund? Why are we doing this transaction? Why is the bank doing this transaction as lead manager? Mm. Are there any other pertinent relationships that we should be aware of? You know, in doing this transaction, is it a stepping stone to something else further down the line, or is this helping us, you know, from our own point of view? Have we done some kind of bridge financing, you know, directly to the company, and this is allowing us to step out of that financing and lay off that risk to the broader market? So there's a lots of, you know, reasons why these issuance committees occur and things are discussed. But you could have a situation. So, you know, the moving strike convertible bond is something that was very prevalent in the Japanese market. But you've seen them with this case of Magna Group. It's been migrated over to the US market.
Yeah.
So you may have situations where you have a new product approval in one region and another region comes along. Or, you know, as I did, I moved between regions. You know, you may have capital market staff that have very good knowledge in Asia. But, hey, I've got a great product for you. We used to do loads of these. Let's try it over here. The market's, you know, ready for this. And it's that kind of thing where you want to be really tight around stuff. You also want to look at how long ago some of this stuff was approved and whether there's, you know, been any kind of refresh, any look again, you know, in light of things that have happened more recently. So that, I guess that's really kind of, you know, the warning. And those are the areas that we're saying that people need to look at this stuff. In the case of the premium redemption stuff as well, one observation I would have, being someone that's worked on convertible bond desks that have been part of equities businesses and that have been part of fixed income businesses, I've not had a situation, I don't think, where I was a hybrid. Maybe I was at one time, or moving between businesses, you know, bigger areas. But one thing I sort of noticed that when I was in the sort of a business owned by equities, all of the modeling was driven by the equity derivative business. You're latching onto the equity derivative business for the modeling. So all the modeling around the optionality is really good.
Yeah.
But when you're working from the fixed income side, then again, it's all the fixed income models. And in the case of the premium redemption stuff, these are accreting structures. And I certainly had situations where on some of the desks that I was on, they couldn't properly model this kind of stuff. You'd like to think 20 years on, they can, but I'm also a realist. And I think you and I know when we go into places that actually there's a lot of kind of bootstrapping goes on. There's a lot of, oh yeah, we use this Bloomberg model, but we've not actually got it in our own systems, that kind of stuff. So again, these kind of things, when you're going through the approval process, have, you know, again, revisiting this stuff and saying, well, hang on, last time we did this, we approved it on the basis that we were going to get all this modeling done. Did we actually do it?
Yeah.
So that's another area that I think auditors, you know, could look at, just to verify that everything is nice and, you know, tight before any of this stuff gets issued and taken onto the books.
Brilliant. Thanks, Nick. And the other thing we wrote about this month was the T+1 move that we're going to see next year. So the US is going to move in May, I think it is planned, a weekend in May to T+1. There's been a lot of testing that's gone on for years ahead of this. No one's going to be caught by surprise by it, absolutely. But there are definite issues around it. And actually, there have been various bodies that have come out having interviewed various stakeholders and sort of said, you know, it is a concern for us next year. And I think most of the concern runs around the fact that actually the AFME, which I think is a sort of fund type body, came out and said, you know, the move from T+2 to T+1 sounds like you're just knocking 50% off the settlement window. So you're kind of going, okay, I think someone's worked out it's sort of 12 sort of working hours you have to do all your settlement. And so halving it should halve it. But obviously, because of, especially here in Europe where people sit, that window is shrinking massively down to more like 2 hours, not 12 hours. So actually, that is a big change. And I think people are worried, especially if you're a EU-UK based entity that has no particular US bastion, but you are trading a lot of US equities, and a lot of people are. You know, it has been absolutely the growth market. So a lot of funds will be chasing performance by being allocated to the US. So if you're a based over here, you know, you don't really have the wherewithal to keep an eye on settlement in such a narrow window, and you can't hand your book over, for example. I mean, the banks will be fine. They can hand their books geographically from, you know, London to the States, to Asia, for example, to make sure that, you know, you have a properly staffed up teams to make sure that this all goes through. But if you're just based over here, it could be a real challenge. It could be a problem. So,
yeah, I mean, as you and I know, in our experiences, a lot of the arbitrage strategies we were doing were using US stocks, US listed stocks.
Yeah.
And of course, in arbitrage, you know, the margins are very thin.
Yeah.
And any mistake, any slip up, and you can eradicate that potential.
Yeah, profit. even now with everything on T2, which is the equity side and the FX side, you know, as you say, even one misbooking and then you fail for a day, you know, that's a cost. But actually, if you move one of the legs to T1 and suddenly, you know, that bid is settling and you're getting cash in, or maybe cash is going out, but then the other side isn't. So suddenly there's a cash mismatch. So you're going to have to worry about how you fund that overnight. Now, one night's funding, people think, well, that's kind of, you know, nothing really to worry about. But actually, that's probably true 2 years ago or even a year ago with rates kind of around zero. But now up at 5%, you know, overnight funding, you know, these aren't piddling small trades. You know, you're going to be doing decent sized trades. So actually, you know, that could add up. And if you're looking to make quite a small turn on this thing, you've either got, you know, much greater risk of a fail, which is going to cost you, and you may even be fined on as well, sort of doubling up the problem. And then, yeah, you'll have a funding. You've got to somehow fund that position for that one day until everything else then sort of attaches to it, and then you have a package that is sort of settling as is. So, yeah, that is another big issue that could come from this.
So where are we saying to people they need to be looking? What do they need to do to get ready for this? I mean, obviously you said there's a lot of testing going on, but where's the smart, you know, move by audit now at this time?
I think you need to, you know, at that weekend, I'm sure the Fed or whoever there'll be a lot of funds in the market to make sure that if there is a trip up, that, you know, there isn't a proper meltdown because of it. But, you know, if there are more fines being issued or there's things keep getting bought in or whatever it is, I think you need to be aware of, you know, how you deal with the allocation of those costs. I mean, does it go direct to that desk? Does it go to, you know, your stock borrow desk, wherever it may be? So I think that's certainly one of the main areas that I would think that people should be keeping an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you say, I think the banks are probably the place where things are going to go okay. The place I can really see and envisage things going, you know, more sideways are people that are in the chain. So the interdealer brokers, you know, that are going to get let down on one side or the other. And, you know, you having been an interdealer broker myself, I know the pressure that you're under, you know, to be good with your customers, and it's very difficult to raise, you know, when there are problems and so on. So I think, you know, IDBs really need to look at this because they are very exposed, or potentially could be very exposed, particularly on the fails and those kind of costs versus their profit margins. And then I would say also, you know, just the brokerages as well.
Yeah.
That are, again, passing stuff through for people and reliant on everyone, you know, working in the chain, and may not have the ability to go out and do, you know, financing themselves or borrow themselves. But maybe they need to look at that as kind of fail safe as well.
Brilliant. No, I think that's good.
Great. Well, that's November's horizon unpacked. We've just got a month to go. We've got December's one lining up. I've got something already in the pipeline for that, so don't worry.
Please, don't. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah. And it will have some historical resonance.